De Lucid Air is ontworpen en ontwikkeld in Californië. En voorzien van de beste innovaties uit Silicon Valley. Een rijbereik tot 839 kilometer. Ultrasnel laden. En de prestaties van een sportwagen. Met een zakelijke financial lease rijdt u de Lucid Air vanaf €899 per maand. Bezoek onze showroom in Hilversum. Of boek een proefrit op lucidmotors.com.
Beste luisteraar van de Friday Move. Je gaat luisteren naar een speciaal cadeautje tijdens de feestdagen van BNR voor jou. Wilfred Gené interviewde Yuval Noah Harari. Harari is een historicus en futuroloog en dat levert een zeer interessant gesprek op. Veel plezier met je podcast.
Yuval Noah Harari. Met boeken als Homo Sapiens, Homo Deus en 21 lessen voor de 21ste eeuw veroverde hij de wereld. Niet alleen verkocht hij tientallen miljoenen boeken met zijn voorspellingen over de toekomst van de mensheid, ook de grote der aarde zoals Obama, Gates of Zuckerberg nemen zijn waarschuwingen op het gebied van klimaat, overbevolking, werkloosheid en artificial intelligence uitermate serieus. Dat is een compliment, maar dat brengt ook een bepaalde druk met zich mee.
I have to be kind of very careful about what I say, about what I write, because people take it seriously. So, yeah. You know, when I wrote Sapiens originally, part of what made it easier for me to write, I had no idea it would be very successful. I felt I was writing for myself, for my students, so I could be very playful. And now it's much more difficult because you have to kind of really pay attention to what you say. You know, I think today in the world we see this emerging trend of authentic leaders or authentic politicians that just say the first thing that comes up in their mind. And this is extremely dangerous. I think that, you know, whether you're a politician or a public intellectual or whatever, if you're a person that many people listen to, then authenticity is very bad. We don't need authentic leaders.
No?
We need responsible leaders. I mean, you know, politics is not a therapy session. You want to be authentic and say the first thing that comes in your mind, go to a psychiatrist, go to a psychologist. I mean, that's the place to do it. I mean, as a leader, like, your words are like seeds that are planted in the minds of millions of people. So you have to be very, very careful. You need a wall. I mean, people love walls today. So you need a wall between your mind and your mouth. And be very careful about what you allow to go out.
Are you surprised people take you serious?
Sometimes. But you know, I got used to it. So. You know.
And how does that feel? That so many people take you serious?
So, as I said, it feels stressful. It places again a lot of responsibility. I try as much as possible to kind of keep to what I know. And, you know, there is always the temptation to go further. People ask me questions I don't know the answer to. They expect me to come up with solutions that I don't know. So a very important part of the job is to know my own limitations. Part of the problem is that when people follow somebody, there is a tendency to shift responsibility from me to them. And part of the job is to resist it and to return the responsibility to people that I don't know the answer to these questions or I don't know what to do. I can raise the question, but if I have a kind of pet theory about how to solve it, and I'm not sure that it's really good, it's very important to kind of resist the temptation to throw it on people as the answer.
You're not a guru.
I try not to be. I mean, again,
but some people say you are.
A lot of people say that I am. I try not to be. I think it's very dangerous both to them and to me. It's dangerous to them because then they stop thinking, they stop making an effort, they expect the guru to tell them what to do. It's even more dangerous in the way to the person who is put in that place because most people are not qualified for it.
You are?
I'm not. I mean, it goes to your head. Believing that you have all the answer, and that's very, very dangerous. It kind of completely, it inflates your ego and it twists your mind, and it's really dangerous.
But the other host told you, I feel like I'm on the stage with a rock star. Do you feel like a rock star every now and then?
Sometimes, but in the terms of the reception that people give you. Still, a rock star is better than a guru.
Yeah. Most of the time, hè?
Most
of the time.
Door zijn bekendheid en contacten met de leiders en bepalers in de wereld wordt Harari door bepaalde groeperingen als gekleurd en gevaarlijk gezien. Bijvoorbeeld als belangrijk adviseur van het World Economic Forum. Begrijpt hij deze kritiek?
When you meet all these leaders, business leaders, political leaders, one of the things you realize is that nobody really knows what is happening. Nobody has all the answers. And people have this fantasy about these extremely powerful people or a group of powerful people. They control the whole world.
Yeah, the conspiracy theories.
Yeah, and one of the things you realize as when you meet these people, but also you realize from history, I mean, nobody has that kind of power. I mean, the real world is so messy, is so complicated. You look at a real conspiracy, you know, I don't know, like the American invasion of Iraq or the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You have such powerful countries with your big military and intelligence services and everything, and they come in with a big plan and all goes wrong. There are so many things they didn't expect. The results often are the exact opposite of what they planned. The idea that anybody or any small group of people have so much power and understanding that they can plan, like, I don't know, 10 moves ahead on the global chess player, like, I don't know, they can release a virus and create a pandemic for some kind of economic gain or political. Nobody is able to do that. And the historical example that you should come back to are things like the Iraq War. Mm. You have the most powerful country in the world that getting it completely wrong, and the end result is the opposite of what they planned, what they expected.
But what is it with these people who think about these conspiracies? What's the reason you think they feel like this? Are they
unhappy? I think it's kind of, in a very strange way, it's a feel-good narrative. For two reasons. First of all, you feel you understand the world. One of the most difficult things about being a human being is that we don't understand the world.
No.
And when you believe, I mean, the most typical type of conspiracy theories, they are a kind of one size fits all. There is one conspiracy in the world, it explains everything.
The Great Reset.
And yeah, whatever it is. And the comforting things about it is, first of all, that I understand everything. I understand everything about the world. And this is a nice feeling, especially if I'm the only one who understands or a small, I mean, being in the know, like all these people, they are fooled by the conspiracy. I'm not. I know the truth. So this is a very comforting feeling. Another thing, which is quite strange, but I think that psychologically there is something about it, then it means that potentially it's easy to solve the problem.
How?
Because there is just this small group of people who are causing all the problem. So if we can somehow defeat them, if we can somehow get rid of them, that's it, problem solved. I mean, if you think about the economic difficulties of the world, or you think about climate change, if you imagine that the source of the problem is just one small group of people, again, there is something very comforting about that, because it means that the problem is actually not so complicated. We just need to do something about these people.
So they like to simplify everything.
Yeah.
So then they can understand the world. That's what they do. In a way,
In a way, yes. Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, there are also very valid fears which are expressed in many of these conspiracies. I mean, many of these conspiracies I'm having a lack of control and feeling that I'm being monitored, that I'm being surveyed. And this is an extremely valid fear, because we are reaching a point for the first time in human history when it is becoming technically possible to follow everybody all the time. Yeah. and to actually understand people better than they understand themselves. This was never possible before in history, not even in the most totalitarian regimes. The Soviet Union, the KGB, couldn't follow everybody all the time.
But now they take your smartphone.
And, now it's yes. Again, very often the conspiracy theories, they focus on the wrong place or on the wrong technology. Like you have all these people are afraid of being implanted with chips. And again, this is comforting. Because then they can tell themselves, nobody has yet implanted me with a chip in the brain, and I will resist if they come, so I'm safe. They don't understand it's not a chip in the brain, it's the smartphone. That's the really dangerous technology, and you already have it.
Yeah, you take it everywhere.
You take it, and this is where you get your theories from.
Yeah.
So, but the kernel of the fear, they are absolutely, they should be terrified of this situation of being followed all the time and being monitored.
But with this development, is there a possibility in future there could be a small group of people who will be in control of the world then with this technology you're describing?
If it happens, everybody will know it. One of the other things that characterizes these theories is that they imagine this small group of people as doing two things simultaneously. They control everything and they keep it secret at the same time. Mm. This is not possible. There are situations in history when a small group of people have enormous power and control, maybe not the whole world, but a whole country. But then everybody knows about it. If I tell you that the CCP, or the heads of the Chinese Communist Party, they control the whole of China. Did you know? Yes, you knew that. They have enormous power. They follow everybody, but everybody knows it. It's not a secret. Because usually when you have enormous power, you can't hide it. And very often it's actually a precondition for power is that you have this publicity. Again, you look at the Soviet Union. So it's not a secret that Stalin is the key figure. Part of Stalin's power is this personality cult around him. That in every school, in every office, in every house, there is this image, this icon of Stalin. That's part of his power. So at least, I mean, when you look at history, it's impossible at the same time to have enormous power and to hide it. You have to choose. You can hide you can be anonymous, but then you don't have much power usually.
In een van zijn theorieën waarschuwt Harari voor een generatie van vele miljoenen nuttelozen die hun werk verliezen door robots en technologische ontwikkelingen. Dit geldt dus vooral voor mensen in de arbeidersklasse. De vraag is dan ook of Harari het juiste publiek bedient met zijn boeken en lezingen, die toch vooral gericht zijn op hogeropgeleiden.
I talk in all kinds of forums. I publish in all kinds. Like I'm now working. I publish a graphic novel. I'm now publishing a children's book. Part of the reason is to speak in different kind of, you know, different levels to reach as many people as possible, because we need as many people as possible to be part of the conversation. You know, you have these people who say that they have this kind of technocratic vision, that they say that people who don't have enough education or whatever, they shouldn't be part of the process because they don't understand enough. And that's completely wrong. Because the key to taking part in the political discussion is not having a certain level of education. It's having a certain type of life experience. The problem is that if only, I don't know, people with college education get to be part of the conversation, they can't really represent the experiences and the interests of everybody.
But that's happening right now, don't you think so? With all the things you're doing all over the world, most of the people are well-educated, maybe a little bit rich. So therefore, it's quite hard to reach the other people.
Yeah, it's hard, but this is the job. This is the job of, I think, of public intellectuals.
How many times did you tell this story already?
Which one?
The one you did here. The one about the development and about the education for the kids and things like that. How many times?
Quite a few times.
Yes.
Quite a few times.
So then it becomes a story, or it's still the truth?
Stories are not necessarily untrue. I mean, story is a kind of, it's the form, it's the structure. One of the problems of humanity is that fictional stories usually have an inherent advantage over true stories. I mean, for two reasons. First of all, the truth is often very complicated. Fiction can be made as simple as you want it. Again, like with conspiracy theories. Like climate change is extremely, I mean, the pandemic. just to understand what a virus is. It's really complicated because biology is complicated. Like a virus is not even, you know, an animal or a bacteria. It's not a cell. It's just a package of code. It's genetic code that has the amazing ability to infiltrate your cells, hijack the mechanisms of the cell, and produce more copies of this code. It's just code. And this is such a difficult thing to grasp. It's much easier to believe a story that you have a group of billionaires or whatever who created this in order to take over the world. So one advantage of fiction is that it can be made very simple. Secondly, the truth is often painful, is often unwelcome. I don't know, we have now elections in Israel. A politician in Israel that will go around talking about, I don't know, the suffering that the Israeli occupation inflicts on Palestinians will not get many votes that way.
Mensen hebben dus niet zozeer de waarheid nodig, want die is vaak ingewikkeld en pijnlijk, maar vooral fictie en heroïsche verhalen maken het leven overzichtelijk en behapbaar. Maar hoe geldt het nu voor de theorieën van Harari, die met al zijn succes ook een businessmodel is geworden?
Are you telling the truth?
I try to as much as possible.
You're sure? You're sure about it?
Not always. Again, I try to, as I said in the beginning, I try to be very aware and responsible about what I'm saying. To give you a guarantee that everything I'm saying is 100% true. It's all based on... No. And that's part of, you know, part of the responsibility also, I think, of scientists, but also of democratic institutions, is to always take into account the options that we are wrong. And this is a key characteristic, both of scientific institutions.
And be honest about it when you're wrong. That's very important.
Be honest about it, but also leave room for your own errors. Assume in advance that you're also making errors. So you have these self-correcting mechanisms built in. In science, we have self-correcting mechanisms built into every scientific institution. This is what defines them as a scientific institution and not a religion. Religions often don't have any room for self-correcting mechanisms. They assume that they have the whole truth, the eternal truth. So it's not like you get a new edition of the Bible every few years. Oh, we discovered some error. We need to change that.
Yeah, but for some people, your books are a new Bible.
That's very dangerous.
Is that dangerous?
That's very dangerous. I mean, you know, if I could, I would have a new edition of the book every few years, but it's not workable. And at some point, you just need to leave it aside. And
but it has become business as well. You have your own corporation, Sapienship.
Yeah.
You have people working for you.
Yeah.
How authentic can it be then still, if it's getting that
big? As I said, I don't want to be authentic. I want to be responsible. It's a very different thing.
Yeah.
And... again, you need to play the game. That, you know, you want to play football, you need a team. You want to play in the world today, you need a corporation or some other kind of organization. To make a change in the world, I think institutions are key. 50 people who work together in an institution, an organization, a corporation, however you call it, can make a much bigger change than 500 individual activists, each trying to do their own thing.
We have to work together, like you always say.
We have to work together.
That's one of the solutions for the problems in the next coming years, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What's your responsibility in that then? You say it's my responsibility. How do you describe your responsibility then?
Not just me again, but my our organization, we define our purpose as focusing the global conversation on the most important problems. That's, I mean, you can't solve all the problems in the world by yourself. You usually focus on one thing and focus on that. So that's our focus. And we think that part of the issue in the world is that people often get their priorities wrong. They focus on problems which are real problems, but much lower down, I think terrorism. Terrorists kill a small number of people, but cause millions to be terrified. This is the power of terror.
Yeah, but you describe them as weak people who use an ultimate weapon that doesn't really work, but only the fear.
Yeah, but it's a very powerful weapon because, you know, you do see that governments fall.
Yeah.
And that elections are decided by these terror activities whose they don't really pose a danger to human society like climate change or like the rise of disruptive technologies such as artificial intelligence, but you still see in much of the world the political discussion focuses on terrorism, whereas they have no views on AI, on artificial intelligence. So part of the way we define our job is to focus the conversation on the most important challenge.
Om te voorkomen dat computers en AI de macht overnemen, moeten we onszelf beter leren kennen. Al dus een van de theorieën van Harari. Maar hoe zit dat eigenlijk bij hemzelf?
Who are you?
Who am I? That's a very difficult question. I'm still exploring that. I think part of the issue with identity is that too many people, when they ask this question, who am I, they settle for some very narrow answer. Like, I belong to this tribe or to this group of people, and that's the most important thing or the only thing I need to know about myself. And this is always wrong. We are such complicated entities. To know who I am, I need a very, very broad view. You know, there are the immediate components that came from my culture, from my country, from the last few years. And then there are the things I got from millions or billions of years of evolution, like the deepest part of myself, the deepest emotions, fear, love, they didn't come from Jewish religion or Israeli culture or from human history. They come from billions of years of evolution.
But in one of your books you say you have to know yourself before algorithms will do.
Yes.
That's what you say. Mm-hmm. But is that possible then, you think?
Yes, to some extent, yes, because, you know, the technology is still not there. I mean, it is possible today to collect a lot more information about you than in any previous time, but to actually observe what's happening inside you, this is something that the technology is still incapable of doing. And
but how can we win this race then before the algorithms do? How do we do that? You're doing a meditation or something like that?
There is no single solution that fits everybody. Like, I put a lot of effort into meditation.
Mm. I like to karaoke. Does that work? Mm? I'd like to karaoke. Is that working as well?
Test it for yourself. It's an empirical question. I mean, different methods work for different people. For some people, it's therapy. For some people, it's hiking in the woods or sports or maybe karaoke or singing. Yes. I mean, test what really works, what helps you get to know yourself better. And when you discover this, then the important thing is give it time. Invest in it. It's one of the best investments you can do.
Yeah, but we don't have time anymore. That's the problem, I think, for most people.
That's a dangerous way of thinking. We still have time. No matter who you are, it's not like the entire world is just on you. On your shoulders, and if you don't have kind of time to just explore, to just observe, then we are living in a very toxic information world, and we need time to detoxify our mind. The same way that we need time, I mean, we need time to rest our body, to clean it, to feed it. We can't function otherwise. It's the same thing with our mind. We also need to give our mind times for rest. We need to give it a good diet. We need to give it an ability to detoxify itself from all the toxic information out there. And if we don't do that, then we are not being more efficient. We are being self-destructive.
Yeah. Your husband is very important to this as well.
Yeah.
For 20 years, you're very, very happy. You don't have kids, do you?
We don't have kids. No.
Do you feel bad about that?
No.
No?
It never crossed my mind, really. I mean, it's not like I made this big decision. If I didn't know that people are doing it, I would never have thought about it myself. You know, it's like I never decided not to have a whale. Why not? I don't know. I just never crossed my mind that maybe I'll have a whale. So other people, they make their own decisions. I think the really big question about having kids is, why do we do it?
Yeah.
That some people, they are doing it as a kind of extension of themselves. Like, they have, again, this huge pile of things they are carrying, and they want to pass it on to somebody. I have my, again, and my projects, my hopes, my hatreds, my wars, my religion, my whatever, and it must continue after me. So I have these kids, and I take all this baggage from my head, and I tell them, now you carry that. And I feel good about it. And that's a bad reason to have kids. I think a good reason to have kids is that you are there to help them get rid of their baggage, not to kind of burden them with your baggage. If that's the reason, then that's a wonderful thing.
Geen kinderen dus voor Harari en zijn partner. Wat is dan straks zijn erfenis?
What's your legacy so far, you think then?
I think the most important legacy is to leave behind good self-correcting mechanisms. Whether as an, you know, as an institution, as a country, as an individual, because this is the key. It goes back to what I said about leaving room for error. Whatever we do, whatever we say, there is a lot of error in there. So a very important thing is to leave behind good self-correcting mechanisms. You know, I think about, I don't know, US history. So today it's very, very common to talk about the founding fathers of the United States as, you know, they were racists, they were misogynists, the many of them had slaves, and so forth. And it's all true. But they did one very good thing. They left behind strong self-correcting mechanisms that enabled their own descendants to eventually correct at least some of the mistakes of the founding fathers themselves. And this, I think, is a very good model for everybody, because we don't know what we are doing. If we knew our errors, we would correct them, but we can't. So whatever we leave behind, it should include, as an integral part, a self-correcting mechanism to enable the next generation to go beyond us, to correct our own mistakes.
Praten met Yuval Noah Harari is een uitdaging. Hij vertelt zijn verhalen vol vuur en overtuiging en glipt er verbaal gemakkelijk tussendoor. Of, zoals hij zelf zegt, you need to play the game. En dat kan hij als geen ander. Door het grote succes zijn zijn theorieën ook een businessmodel geworden. Zeg maar gerust big business. Het blijft daardoor enigszins onbevredigend dat hij niet met echte oplossingen komt. Al probeert hij wel het vertrouwen uit te stralen dat die oplossingen er wel zijn.
Part of the thing we need to realize is the enormous power that we have. That if you think again, if you think about the pandemic, if you think about climate change, about things like that, first of all, we need to realize we have the power to solve them, which is not self-evident.
With the stories you're telling us, with all those people who are not useful anymore and things like that, we have to find a solution for that.
Yes, this is not a prophecy that it is inevitable it will happen. It would happen if we make bad decisions. But we have the capacity to make better decisions. I mean, the point about talking about the future is not to make predictions and then be very proud if your predictions come true. What's the point? I mean, to predict something that you can't change, it's not helping anybody. The main job is, you know, to point a finger at some dangerous scenarios in order to encourage people to prevent them. And when these scenarios don't happen and people come and say, but all your predictions didn't come true, that's the good case. That you kind of, it's not a prediction, it's a warning, and you're happy when your warning doesn't come true.
Obama said, yes, we can. Mm-hmm. Can you say the same today? Yes, we can?
We still can. We don't have a lot of time. We don't have a lot of time, whether it's climate change or whether it's regulating artificial intelligence, we have very little time left. It's the next 10, 20, 30 years. We need to tackle these problems and solve them. We can on both fronts.
But we are aware enough of that?
Not yet.
Not yet?
Not yet.
But therefore we have you.
Yeah, with climate change we have growing awareness, but still not enough action. With the dangers of new technologies like AI, we still don't have enough awareness. It's still not a political issue. So that's the job of philosophers, of historians, of public intellectuals to point a finger at it and say this is a very, very huge danger.
Yeah, you're still working on your legacy then.
Yeah.
Good luck with that, Mr. Harari. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lucid Air is ontworpen en ontwikkeld in Californië. En voorzien van de beste innovaties uit Silicon Valley. Een rijbereik tot 839 kilometer. Ultrasnel laden. En de prestaties van een sportwagen. Met een zakelijke financial lease rijdt u de Lucid Air vanaf €899 per maand. Bezoek onze showroom in Hilversum. Of boek een proefrit op lucidmotors.com.